Hello again, and welcome back to another episode of M&A Today. This is Warren Rose, and I am a senior partner at Grosch Rose and Moore LLC. I'm your host for the next 30 minutes, not only today, but every Friday at noon Eastern. Thanks for tuning in to us today. Feel free to send me your thoughts, ideas, or questions during the broadcast, and if I don't get to them live on the air, I will respond via email later after the broadcast. For anyone listening today, we encourage your involvement and feedback, and you can always go back and listen to previous broadcasts that you may have missed or ones that you'd like to hear again. The purpose of this broadcast is to not only educate and inform those of you within the industry, but to give an insight into the advantages of using a professional M&A consulting firm for businesses within the middle market segmentation. Today's broadcast is the second of two parts. And what really kind of created the topic for this show is the number of emails that I receive where there seems to be a certain level of misunderstandings. So, when I just mentioned that you need a professional M&A consulting firm, well, today we will drill down on who, what, when, where, and hows of mergers and acquisitions. This will give the professionals within the industry a framework for what your clients need to understand in the course of the M&A process to meet their expectations. It will also give the potential buyers, sellers, and those seeking a merger a reference point and a deeper understanding of what all this means and what to expect. I mentioned last week that I could have titled today's show Just So We're All on the Same Page, but instead gave it a more professional title of Understanding the Complex World of M&A. Remember, this is the second of two parts, so you can go back and review part one in its entirety after this broadcast. Now to take up where we left off, again, so that we're all on the same page. Today, I want to start by talking about financing. Mergers are generally differentiated from acquisitions partly by the way in which they are financed and partly by the relative size of the companies. Various methods of financing an M&A deal exist. The first of which is cash, payment by cash. Such transactions are usually termed acquisitions rather than mergers, because the shareholders of the target company are removed from the picture and the target comes under the indirect control of the bidder shareholders. The next is stock, payment in the form of the acquiring company stock issued to the shareholders of the acquired company at a given ratio proportional to the value of the latter. Basically, they receive stock in the company that is purchasing the smaller subsidiary. There is a lot to be considered when thinking through all these financial options. There are some elements to think about when choosing the form of payment. When submitting an offer, the acquiring firm should consider other potential bidders and think strategically. The form of payment might be decisive for the seller. With pure cash deals, there is no doubt on the value of the bid without considering an eventual earnout. The contingency of the share payment is indeed removed. Thus, a cash offer preempts competitors better than securities. Taxes are a second element to consider and should be evaluated with the counsel of a competent tax and accounting advisory firm. Third, with a share deal, the buyer's structural capital might be affected and the control of the buyer modified. If the issuance of shares is necessary, shareholders of the acquiring company might prevent such a transaction. Then the balance sheet of the buyer will be modified, and the decision maker should take into account the effects on the reported financial results. For example, in a pure cash deal, which is financed from the company's current account, liquidity ratios might decrease. On the other hand, in a pure stock-for-stock transition, which is financed from the issuance of new shares, the company might show lower profitability ratios. However, economic dilution must prevail towards accounting dilution when making the choice. The form of payment and financing options are tightly linked. If the buyer pays cash, there are three main financing options. The first is cash on hand. It consumes financial slack, excess cash, or unused debt capacity, and may increase debt rating. Another thing to remember is with cash, there are no major transaction costs. And a third thing is the issuance of debt. It consumes financial slack and may decrease the debt rating and increase the cost of debt. Now let's take a look at the motivations. Improving financial performance or reducing risk. The dominant rationale used to explain M&A activity is that acquiring firms seek improved financial performance or reduced risk. The following motives are considered to improve financial performance or to reduce that risk we've talked about. First being economy of scale. This refers to the fact that the combined company can often reduce its fixed cost by removing duplicate departments or operations, lowering the cost of the company relative to the same revenue stream, thus increasing profit margins. Basically, what they're saying there is getting rid of the redundancies. Anything that overlaps can be eliminated, and those costs can also be eliminated or extremely reduced. Next is economy of scope. This refers to the efficiencies primarily associated with demand-side changes, such as increasing or decreasing the scope of marketing and distribution of different types of products. Next, we have increased revenue or market share. This assumes that the buyer will be absorbing a major competitor and thus increase its market power by capturing increased market share to set prices. Then we have cross-selling. For example, a bank buying a stockbroker could then sell its banking products to the stockbroker's customers, while the broker can sign up the bank's customers for brokerage accounts, or a manufacturer can acquire and sell complementary products. Then we have synergy. For example, managerial economies such as the increased opportunity of managerial specialization. Another example is purchasing economies due to increased order size and associated bulk buying discounts. Next, we have taxation. A profitable company can buy a loss maker to use the target's loss as their advantage by reducing their tax liability. In the United States and many other countries, rules are in place to limit the ability of profitable companies to shop for loss-making companies, limiting the tax motive of an acquiring company. But it still does go on today, and extensively so in some cases. Now we'll take a look at geographical or other diversification. This is a move designed to smooth the earning results of conservative investors more confident in investing in the company. However, this does not always deliver value to the shareholders. Then we have resource transfer. Resources are unevenly distributed across firms, and the interaction of target and acquiring firm resources can create value through either overcoming information asymmetry or by combining scarce resources. Now we'll move on to vertical integration. We've talked about this before in one of our broadcasts. Vertical integration occurs when an upstream and downstream firm merge, or one acquires the other. There are several reasons for this to occur. One reason is to internalize an externality problem. A common example of such an externality is double marginalization. Double marginalization occurs when both the upstream and downstream firms have monopoly power and each firm reduces output from the competitive level to the monopoly level, creating two deadweight losses. After a merger, the vertically integrated firm can collect one deadweight loss by setting the downstream firm's output to the competitive level. This increases profits and consumer surplus. A merger that creates a vertically integrated firm can be profitable. Now, hiring. Some companies use acquisitions as an alternative to the normal hiring process. This is especially common when the target is a small private company or is in the startup phase. In this case, the acquiring company simply hires the staff at the target private company, thereby acquiring its talent if that's the main asset and appeal. The target private company simply dissolves and few legal issues are involved. Next, absorption of similar businesses under single management. Similar portfolio invested by two different mutual funds, namely United Money Market Fund and United Growth and Income Fund, caused the management to absorb Money Market Fund into United Growth and Income Fund. Then we'll move on to access to hidden or non-performing assets. This basically is referencing land and real estate more than anything else. Then acquire innovative intellectual properties. Nowadays, intellectual property has become one of the core competencies for companies. Studies have shown that successful knowledge transfer and integration after a merger or acquisition has a positive impact to the firm's innovative capabilities and performance. I don't want to let it go without mentioning megadeals. Deals of at least $1 billion in size tend to fall into four discrete categories. That's either consolidation, capabilities extension, technology-driven market transformation, and going private. All of these and any of these can be a very motivational aspect of why to do a merger or acquisition. I think it's also important to note that on average and across the most commonly studied variables, acquiring firms' financial performance does not positively change as a function of their acquisition activity. Therefore, additional motives for merger and acquisition that may not add shareholder value include diversification. While this may hedge a company against a downturn in an individual industry, it fails to deliver value, since it is possible for individual shareholders to achieve the same hedge by diversifying their portfolios at a much lower cost than those associated with a merger. By the way, in his book, One Up on Wall Street, Peter Lynch termed this diversification phrase, and that's how that came to being. That's a good book. Check it out if you can sometime. One Up on Wall Street by Peter Lynch. Another bit of motivation could come from manager's hubris. That's the manager's overconfidence about expected synergies from M&A, which results in overpaying on the target company. The effect of manager's overconfidence on M&A has been shown to hold both for CEOs and board directors. Next, empire building. Managers have larger companies to manage and hence more power. A lot of times these decisions and motivations are basically just ego-driven. And finally, a motivation could even be for manager's compensation. In the past, certain executive management teams had their payout based on the total amount of profit of the company, instead of the profit per share, which would give the team a perverse incentive to buy companies to increase the total profit while decreasing the profit per share, which basically hurts the owners of the company and or the shareholders. Next, let's look at statutory and consolidated mergers. Next, I want to look at the M&A process that results in the restructuring of a business's purpose, corporate governance, and brand identity. The first is a statutory merger. That is a merger in which the acquiring company survives and the target company dissolves. The purpose of this merger is to transfer the assets and capital of the target company into the acquiring company without having to maintain the target company as a subsidiary. Next, a consolidated merger. That is a merger in which the entirely new legal company is formed through combining the acquiring company and the target company. The purpose of this merger is to create a new legal entity with the capital and assets of the merged acquirer and target company. Both the acquiring and target company are dissolved in the process. I wanted to take this time in the show to tell you a few things about our firm, Grosch Rose & Moore, LLC. We have always believed that our client approach sets us apart from our competition. First and foremost, we listen and then take that knowledge leveraged by our experience and vast contacts to create the right fit. We then focus on what is important to you, your business, and any shareholders. We also strive to conduct ourselves in a manner that makes certain everyone is treated fairly and equitably. Really, regardless of who you contract with and what they do, you need an M&A advisory firm that not only has the knowledge and experience to get things done, but understands and cares about your business goals. So, if you are looking to buy, sell, consolidate, form a strategic alliance, get a business valuation or consultation, call me at 303-941-7865 or email me at wrose@groschrosemoore.com. Bottom line, we only want a fee if we've earned it. Whether it's on the buy or the sell side, no deal, no fee. It's that simple. I also think it's important for us today to discuss brand considerations. Mergers and acquisitions often create brand problems, beginning with what to call the company after the transaction and going down into detail about what to do about overlapping and competing product brands. Decisions about what brand equity to write off are not inconsequential. And given the ability for the right brand choices to drive preference and earn a price premium, the future success of a merger or acquisition depends on making wise brand choices. Brand decision makers essentially can choose from four different approaches to dealing with naming issues, each with separate pros and cons. Number one, keep one name and discontinue the other. The strongest legacy brand with the best prospects for the future lives on. In the merger of United Airlines and Continental Airlines, the United brand continued to move forward while Continental was retired. Now, number two, keep one name and demote the other. The strongest brand name becomes the company name, and the weaker one is demoted to a divisional brand or product brand. An example is Caterpillar Inc., keeping the Bucyrus International name. Bucyrus became a brand instead of the name of the company. Number three, keep both names and use them together. Some companies try to please everyone and keep the value of both brands by using them together. This can create an unwieldy name, such as in the case of Prince Waterhouse Coopers, which has since changed its brand to PwC. Fourth, discard both legacy brands and adopt a totally new one. The classic example is the merger of Bell Atlantic and GTE, which became Verizon Communication. Not every merger with a new name is successful, though. By consolidating into YRC Worldwide, the company lost a considerable value of both Yellow Freight and Roadway Corporation. The factors influencing brand decisions in a merger or acquisition transition can range from political to tactical. Ego can drive choice just as well as rational factors such as brand value and costs involved with changing brands. Beyond the bigger issue of what to call the company after the transaction comes the ongoing detailed choices about what divisional, product, and service brands to keep. The detailed decisions about the brand portfolio are covered under the topics of brand architecture. I don't want the broadcast to get away from me today without talking about cross-border M&A deals. In a study conducted by Lehman Brothers, it was found that on average, large M&A deals cause the domestic currency of the target corporation to appreciate by 1% relative to the acquirer's local currency. Until 2018, about 280,000 plus cross-border deals have been conducted, which accumulates to a total value of over $24 billion U.S. dollars. The rise of globalization has exponentially increased the necessities for agencies such as the Mergers and Acquisitions International Clearing. That is also known by the acronym of MAIC. On a global basis, the value of cross-border mergers and acquisitions rose sevenfold during the 1990s. In 1997 alone, there were over 2,333 cross-border transactions worth a total of approximately $298 billion. And remember that, just in 1997. The vast literature on empirical studies over value creation in a cross-border M&A is not conclusive, but points to higher returns in cross-border M&As compared to domestic ones when the acquired firm has the capacity to exploit resources and knowledge. We're hearing a lot about China recently, but China, for example, in securing regulatory approval, it can be very complex due to an extensive group of various stakeholders at each level of government. In the United Kingdom, acquirers may face pension regulators with significant powers, in addition to an overall M&A environment that is generally more seller-friendly than the U.S. Nonetheless, the current surge in global cross-border M&A has been called the new era of global economic discovery. And again, referencing China, in little more than a decade, M&A deals in China increased by a factor of 20, from 69 to 2000 to more than 1,300 in 2013. In 2014, Europe registered its highest levels of M&A deal activity since the financial crisis. This was driven by U.S. and Asian acquirers, inbound M&A at a $320.6 billion rate. That reached record highs by both deal value and deal count since 2001. Approximately 23% of 416 M&A deals announced in the U.S. M&A market in 2014 involved non-U.S. acquirers. For 2016, market uncertainties, including Brexit, which is still an issue, and the potential reform from a U.S. presidential election, contributed to cross-border M&A activity lagging roughly 20% behind the 2015 activity. In 2017, the controversial trend, which started in 2015, decreasing total value but rising total number of cross-border deals, kept going. Compare on a year-on-year basis, 2016 to 17, the total number of cross-border deals decreased by 4.2%, while cumulative value increased by 0.6%. Even mergers of companies with headquarters in the same country can often be considered international in scale and require additional custodial services. For example, when Boeing acquired McDonnell Douglas, the two American companies had to integrate operations in dozens of countries around the world. This is just as true for other apparently single-country mergers, such as the $29 billion merger of Swiss drug company maker Sandoz and the group now known as Novartis. Continuing on the international path, the M&A practice in emerging countries differs from more mature economies, although transaction management and valuation tools share a common basic methodology. In China, India, or Brazil, for example, differences affect the formation of asset price and on the structuring of deals. Profitability expectations and risk, represented by a discount rate, must both be properly adjusted. In an M&A perspective, differences between emerging and more mature economies include 1. A less developed system of property rights, 2. Less reliable financial information, and 3. Cultural differences in negotiation, and finally, 4. A higher degree of competition for the best targets. As a matter of fact, we have that going on right now with a client that we have in Costa Rica. It is a coffee farm and fully operational mill in one of the most beautiful corners of the planet, Costa Rica. Now this company, they're registered with the National Institute of Coffee in Costa Rica, have an official status of a coffee exporter worldwide. They have retail permits in Costa Rica and a quality certificate from the Costa Rica Coffee Institute with a rating of excellent. They sit on almost 104 acres, two rivers. It's an amazing, amazing opportunity. So there is a lot of interest in those sort of things. And part of that is because of the untapped resources they have as well. If you start looking at potential future revenues for something like that, those streams are a source of drinking water. You could put in a small hydropower station there, a hydroponic gardening system, fish farms. You could put up an eco hotel there. You could do all sorts of things that would add to the revenue streams, and you can do it fairly reasonably. That's the other thing about Costa Rica. They're really developing right now, and the cost of doing something there and acquiring something is very low compared to the return on investment that you might end up with. So it really pays to look at a country like Costa Rica. We currently have, I think, in the neighborhood of 15 clients there, and that's growing every week. We're adding more. And it's everything from resorts and hotels to the food industry. Here's a coffee plantation I was just talking about. There's all sorts of things in the manufacturing side, health and beauty care. And again, their operational costs are so low. And because of that, their profit margins and overall profitability, their EBITDA is out of this world. We have many of them where the EBITDA is at 50% of their gross revenues. So there's a lot of money to be made in a country like Costa Rica, and it's a really fantastic place between the government support you get for doing business there, just the overall environment there, and just I love the people there as well. So great place to do business. So we've run out of time today. Thanks again for listening to M&A Today. We'll talk to you all again next Friday at noon Eastern.